Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 15. The Pandavas retire timely, text 27. Desha kalata yuktani vrishtapo pashyamani cha paranti smaratashchitam govinda behitani me. Translation. Arjuna speaking to Yudhisthira Maharaj. Now I am attracted to those instructions imparted to me by the personality of Godhead, Govinda, because they are impregnated with instructions for relieving the burning heart in all circumstances of time and space. Purport. Herein, Arjuna refers to the instruction of the Bhagavad Gita, which was imparted to him by the Lord on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The Lord left behind him the instructions of the Bhagavad Gita, not for the benefit of Arjuna alone, but also for all time and in all lands. The Bhagavad Gita, being spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the essence of all Vedic wisdom. It is nicely presented by the Lord himself. For all who have very little time to go through the vast Vedic literatures like the Upanishads, Puranas, and Vedanta Sutras, it is put within the study of the great historical epic, Mahabharata, which is especially prepared for the less intelligent class, namely the women, the laborers, and those who are worthless descendants of the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and higher sections of the Vaishyas. The problem which arose in the heart of Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra was solved by the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Again, after the departure of the Lord from the vision of earthly people, when Arjuna was face to face with being vanquished in his acquired power and prominence, he wanted again to remember the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, just to teach all concerned that the Bhagavad Gita can be consulted in all critical times, not only for solace from all kinds of mental agonies, but also for the way out of great entanglements which may embarrass one in some critical hour. We'll take the purport in sections. Om agena timanandasya gyananjana chavakaya chakshun minitam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha.
Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Yoga Vakrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
And what Arjuna is saying, you are not experiencing ordinary grief and devastation. You are witness to Arjuna's being overwhelmed with separation from Govinda. It's a pain, but it's also a heart-soothing pain. This cannot be understood on the material platform. Just like when you're reading in Chaitanya Charitamrita about the manifestations of separation felt by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It seems like agony, and it is, but it's not material agony. Feeling separation from Krishna is soothing for the heart. At the same time, it's agonizing. This is a contradiction which cannot be resolved on the material platform. Because while feeling separation from Krishna, you're more intensely thinking about Krishna. This is the explanation that Krishna gave to the gopis after disappearing and then reappearing. He said, I know what I'm doing. It's not that I'm actually failing in reciprocating with you. We may deal with this Leela in the coming days. We'll see. So, I promise that I will always reciprocate with my devotee. And I have. I wanted to give you the highest thing, love of Krishna and separation. So I left. This is reciprocation. So you would say that, well, reciprocation means that Krishna should always be present. But Krishna is most present through separation. That cannot be understood on a material platform. So therefore, to give the gopis the highest, Krishna left them, apparently. And then he even told them that, actually, I didn't disappear. You just couldn't see me from an unseen vantage point. I was watching your agony of separation. So you might say, from the material point of view, this is sadistic. He puts them in agony by his disappearance, and meanwhile, from an unseen place, he's watching them go through their agony. But that is the nature of pure love of Krishna at its highest level, and that's the nature of Krishna's dealings with his devotees. He does want to give them the best. But what Krishna gives as the best cannot be always understood from the material platform. And we also can have this problem of trying to understand, why is Krishna doing this to me? Why is this happening to me? We're using our material senses to analyze. This is not the package I wanted. This is not the gift I wanted. So as we become older as devotees, we need to reanalyze our situation and see, what is Krishna actually giving me? Am I open? Am I seeing what Krishna is doing to me for my benefit? Or am I imposing my material conceptions on Krishna? Karma Mishra Bhakti means bhakti mixed with a desire for karmic benefit. In ordinary language, this is known as prosperity religion. And of course, there can also be Kama Mishra Bhakti, bhakti overladen with just out and out material desire. Out and out lust. And we have to be more discriminating as we become mature. Where am I really at? Just like in relationships, I've seen couples do that. Where are we really at? What are we really about? Let's talk about it. what's our motivation? Well, the supreme relationship is with Krishna, and the devotee is always trying to understand, what am I about? What is this relationship about? Where am I really at? The gopis were wondering themselves, what is this all about? We sacrifice everything for Krishna and he disappears. What is this? We may talk about that in coming days, how they put questions toward Krishna, actually accusing him in a very indirect way. In other words, what kind of lover are you? You've done this, you've done that, you've done that. But overwhelmed by affection for Krishna, they couldn't exactly accuse him directly. So they had to kind of float the accusations over to him in a very cultured way. How could you treat us like this? Then Krishna explained. In a very humble way, Krishna explained, it seems like I mistreated you and I'm aware of your great sacrifice, but actually, I wanted to become indebted to you. I wanted to give you the best. You did something I didn't do. You left your family, relatives, children, husband, wife, mother, father. You left all your honor and raced out to the forest to be with me. I never did that. I never left my family. Never left my mother, Yashoda, Nanda Maharaj. I never left my friends, the Cowherd Boys. So you've done all that. How can I repay you? I can't repay you, even in the lifetime of Brahma. But actually, indirectly, Krishna is saying, I have repaid you. I've become your debtor. That's the greatest payment, that I'm now under the control of your love. I gave you the highest gift. I let you experience love of Krishna and separation. And I become under your control. This is all my arrangement. And actually the gopis realize, yes, Krishna has orchestrated this whole event so that he's under our control. He's always in debt to us. He's done that. He's arranged that. He's allowed us to conquer him with our love. So they actually realize Krishna, actually, he is the supreme personality of pleasure, Govinda. I've been using this terminology for Krishna recently. Who can object to the supreme personality of pleasure? Supreme personality of Godhead, we got a problem. We don't want anyone controlling us, right? We don't want supreme Ishwar. If there is God, he should accept some worship from us and let us do our thing. And in fact, if he really wants to be beneficial, he should help with our material desires and prosperity. We don't know about Krishna, right? We're a little doubtful. What is Krishna's program? What's he really going to do for us? This is the way we approach relationships in Kali Yuga. What have you done for me? What are you going to do for me? That you size the other person up as to their potential for aiding you in your quest to enjoy the material world. So similarly, we size Krishna. I always point out, we wake up in the morning and we turn on the bliss meter. How do I feel? How is Krishna making me feel? What's this chanting doing for me? Am I really feeling ecstatic, as the devotees say? The newcomers learn that lingo very quickly, right? Ecstatic, Prabhu. Nectar, Prabhu. But you wake up in the morning and you immediately ask yourself, is this really the nectar? I know you have to use those words, otherwise devotees, they think they're strange. Every sentence has to have nectar. Ecstatic. Is that really the case, right? I know what you're all thinking. The bliss meter, is taking its readings. I don't know, it's been 3 days, and I haven't felt ecstatic. Am I in the right place? Maybe it's, been 10 years, 11 years, and I don't know. Our material sense perception is so aggressive. You can understand how your material sense perception takes over your life, gobbles you up. There's only one protection against that, and that is hearing and chanting about Krishna and selfless service. That overpowers the material sense perception, which generally overpowers the conditioned soul. Bhakti is a training process to see things Krishna's way. We're so convinced that we're seeing things rightly. I often discuss with devotees how, when you've heard it before, when you're in your early 20s, you think you got it all figured out. Yeah, I know. I know what I'm doing. It's all obvious. This is the way it's going to be. those who have been doing outreach work at the urban centers for the past 20 years. They have seen this movie so many times. I know. I'm 20, I'm 21, I'm 22. I know exactly what I want, how I feel. I don't need any advice. I got it all figured out. And then, how does the movie progress? As soon as they become 25, 26. Oh, what a fool I was. I didn't know anything. I was talking to Yolanda Woody last night, walking back to the house. She became a devotee when she was around 20 or 19 or something like that. And now she's 30. So I asked her, so looking back, how was it?
Oh, it was crazy.
Thought I knew everything. So, this tendency of being overpowered by material sense perception is not something simply that late teens or early 20s people go through. It's actually the basic principle of material existence. And naturally we should be wondering, what do we have in our arsenal to overpower this contamination? By a regulated program of hearing and chanting about Krishna and selfless service according to your ashram style, you can actually start to see things Krishna's way, and that is the glory of bhakti. In a previous purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, discretion is the better part of valor, and one must learn how to discriminate between actions which may be pleasing to the Lord and those which may not be pleasing to the Lord. An action is thus judged by the Lord's pleasure or displeasure. There is no room for personal whims. We must always be guided by the pleasure of the Lord. Such action is called yoga karmasu kaushalam, or actions performed which are linked with the Supreme Lord. That is the art of doing a thing perfectly. It's a very beautiful presentation. Our actions are guided by the pleasure of Krishna. How do you learn how to do that? That's the whole process of bhakti. That's why Krishna arranges that his devotee teach others how to be devotees. To be a devotee doesn't mean simply to wear neck beads. You can get them in any temple gift shop. Doesn't even mean to have a Sanskrit name. To be a devotee means to try to be guided by Krishna's pleasure. And we never think we've got that mastered. A devotee is always thinking, I just can't sense Krishna's pleasure well enough. This is another reason why Krishna says he puts his devotee in separation. There are two levels in his explanation that he gave to the gopis. On the first level, he said, the agony of separation makes a non-perfect devotee, a devotee aspiring for perfection, the agony of separation makes that devotee always think, oh, I had Krishna, I lost him. I had some realization of Krishna, in other words. Where is it now? I'm feeling dry. I'm feeling overwhelmed by material nature. Where is Krishna? That mentality in a practicing devotee produces purification. You become purified of lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, and illusion. Those things, by the way, those six monsters always accompany the material mind. So don't wonder about it. If you have a material mind, it's accompanied by those six monsters. Lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, illusion. So accept that for what it is and then come up with a program to deal with the monsters. So just remember, those monsters always accompany the material mind. Take that as a given fact and then chart out your life accordingly. How are you going to handle it? So the bhakti program means how to purify the mind by focusing on Krishna. Focusing on Krishna means focusing on Krishna's service. hearing about Krishna as a service, chanting about Krishna as a service. And we have all our senses for Krishna's service. That's the bhakti program. The more you can successfully engage all of your senses in Krishna's service, the more successful your spiritual life is. We want to be guided in how to judge Krishna's pleasure. Please understand that. I know it takes a while when we come to bhakti to start peeling back the layers of impersonalism. We really can't appreciate immediately that we're dealing with the Supreme Personality of Pleasure. We have some vague conception. I'm relating to, well, the whatever, but now I know the whatever is called Krishna. It's hard for us. We're so covered to understand how the process of bhakti is so personal. Especially since we don't take things in a cheap way and just go around saying, God was talking to me last night. I had a talk with God last night. We know. What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Tesham satatayuktanam bhajatam priti-purvakam. Vidami buddhi yogam tam. I only talk to those who have preeti, affection. That doesn't mean any material. Your affection is shown by satatayuktanam, constantly engaging in devotional service with the affection. Not sporadic. If there's actually affection, how can the service be sporadic? So there are two things that go together. Satatayuktanam bhajatam priti. The steadiness and the affection. In the beginning we stress steadiness, Prabhu. Steadiness, regulation. Learn how to balance. You'll be hearing more from Shesha Prabhu about that. And then gradually, as it starts to dawn upon your head and heart that there is a Supreme Personality of Pleasure, you naturally want to focus on affection. But you'll never get to the affection stage without steadiness. So in the beginning, we may have so many sentiments. I like Jagannath. Who do you like? I like Balaram. I like Sitaram more than Radha Krishna. It's like five-year-olds talking about, you know, how they were brought into the world, the process by which they were brought in, you know, how they got their bodies from their parents. So basically the parents just, well, at least they used to, the parents would just make up a story just to, you know, distract the little kids from speculating, you know. It's the stork, dude. I mean, you're too young to understand. So similarly, when you hear devotees expressing, young devotees, such sentiment that, oh, I like Radha, or I like this, or I like that, or this is my favorite form of the Lord. It's a nice sentiment, but don't take it too seriously at all. Wait till you grow up. And how do you grow up in bhakti? Satatayuktanam, steadiness and preeti, affection. First, there has to be steadiness, the regular principle, sadhana. You think Krishna is so foolish that he wants to begin a deeper relationship with someone who's not steady? How many of you want a relationship like that, even in the ordinary sense? Do you want just a hookup? Or do you want, you know, a lasting, steady relationship? So Krishna's not interested in hookups. Someone who, you know, for momentarily feels some devotional sentiments, and then they go away, or they don't do any service, or they merge back into sense gratification, or try to do both at the same time. Krishna's not so foolish. He's not interested in the hookup culture. That's the Kali Yuga thing. Steadiness. And as experienced householders always point out in Divyahasta Ashram, it's all about steadiness and commitment. The buzz, they tell me, disappears very quickly. That romantic flash, that romantic buzz. And then it all becomes about steadiness, commitment, responsibility, which, relatively speaking, produces real bonding, not the buzz stuff. So often we approach Krishna looking for a buzz. Let's hook up. Yeah. And we're astonished that Krishna's not interested in that. Krishna, I want to hook up. What is this sadhana process? What is this steadiness and commitment? Let's just have a weekend fling. This is the Kali Yuga mentality. To some extent, you can understand it because the suffering is so great in Kali Yuga. People are so bewildered. They just want some instant, immediate relief, anyway, anyhow. So you start thinking, well, maybe Krishna, hooking up with Krishna is better than drugs and sense gratification and careerism. Okay, I'll try it. And, of course, you're fortunate. Any way you come to Krishna, you are fortunate. But once you come, you've got to learn how to be committed and responsible. So we don't mind persons coming who have some temporary motivation, material motivation. Let them come. As Srila Prabhupada writes in Chaitanya Charitamrita, this Krishna conscious movement is meant to attract all kinds of persons, whether they're interested in Krishna or not. But by the association of devotees, they start to develop an interest in Krishna. But don't expect that immediately. Don't expect everyone to walk in the door. Especially here in New Zealand, you don't even expect such a thing. Everyone walks in the door and says, Krishna, where is he? No. People don't know what they want. They just want relief. They want something higher. So we're open to that. Because the Krishna Conscious Society is meant to deal with all kinds of persons, whether they think they're attracted to Krishna or not. But after a while, you should understand that there needs to be a demonstration of steadiness, commitment, and responsibility. Then, when you have sufficiently established your steadiness, you can start thinking about affection, preeti. And then, when there's steadiness and affection, Krishna says, Dadami Buddhi Yovantam, I'll talk to you. So you may say, well, why? What about now, before I reach the stage of steadiness and affection? That means no Krishna whatsoever? Of course it doesn't mean that. You have Bhagavad Gita, and that's what Arjuna is explaining here. Arjuna is in a crisis. Krishna has left the physical vision of this world. Arjuna, he's undergoing symptoms like in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. His mouth, his eyes are drying up. Even the Bhagavatam in this chapter describes his lotus-like heart is drying up. He's crushed by the reality that Krishna has gone. And he gives you many verses describing how all the powers I had have now left me. He could even go to the heavenly planets in his same body. It's all gone now. All his extraordinary powers, this Gandiva bow, he even says, I'm the same Arjuna. I've got the same bow, the same arrows, but now it's all just impotent. So what happened? Arjuna's vast powers that Krishna gave him for crossing over difficult events like the battle of Kurukshetra, those vast powers were not needed for going back to Godhead. So Krishna took the powers away just to show us who is the source of the power. We should never think that anything we do in bhakti is the sign of our potency, our expertise. We should always know that whatever abilities we have, they're coming from Krishna. And if we were more sincere, he would give us much more abilities. That's how we're always thinking. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in one song, Gurudev, I have no good qualities. Your mercy is all I'm made of. So we strive for that realization. Arjuna is giving us a prime case. He goes through a whole list and many verses. I used to be able to do this. I used to be able to do that. Now I'm in this situation. Now I'm in that situation. I can't cope. I can't do anything. All my powers are gone. His conclusion, of course, is going to be, along with the other Pandavas, including Kunti Devi. We'll discuss that in the coming days. The decision is, this shows it's time for us to go back to Godhead. Our mission in this world has come to an end. This is how shrewd a devotee is, to analyze the signs, the symptoms, always in terms of Krishna's pleasure. So Arjuna concluded, Krishna doesn't want me around here anymore. Our mission's done, our purpose is done. He's gone, we're going too. So what would you say? No, Arjuna, stay and enjoy royal happiness and power. The battle group shape is over, you got a good thing going. Stick around and enjoy. But Arjuna's whole life is simply bound up with his friendship relationship with Krishna. What's the point of my being here? Krishna's not here. And he knows that Krishna wants him to go. So after reciting many verses about his current situation, his current predicament, which makes you understand he's sort of back in the same spot he was at the start of the battle of Kurukshetra. He's bewildered. He's overwhelmed. He's having a breakdown. But in that situation, he's remembering instructions that Krishna gave in Bhagavad Gita. And he's teaching us what we can do. He says, I'm attracted to those instructions. In this way, hrittapo pashyamanicha, the burning in my heart is extinguished. Everyone will go through circumstances if you haven't already been through. In which the heart burns without relief, like a raging forest fire and no sign of extinguishing. This grief that overwhelmed the heart of Arjuna is very difficult to describe. It's in friendship, so it is not as agonizing as the grief felt by the Madhurya devotees. Nevertheless, it is almost indescribable. But he says, Govinda's instructions can relieve that burning heart in all circumstances of time and place. In other words, Bhagavad Gita is not just for a certain time in the world's history. It's not simply for a particular place on the globe. You could say, oh, it's just meant for India. You go to India, they say it's just meant for ancient India. Everyone puts it off, you know? Somehow or other, you've got to get Bhagavad Gita off your back. It's a very difficult book to speculate on and twist, but persons are making money trying to do that. The Sanskrit is very clear. The Sanskrit is very precise. There is no argument about the text of Bhagavad Gita. any argument about Bhagavad Gita is always, shall we interpret it or not? Because the speculators can't believe. They can't take it straight on. They can't take it as it is. Because if you take it straight, what does that mean for your life? So immediately they have to think, Krishna is just a metaphor. Krishna is just a literary device. There's actually no real Krishna. As Mahatma Gandhi said. You have to say like that if you want to avoid the impact of Bhagavad Gita. But here we're reading, and Arjuna is saying, Bhagavad Gita can relieve the burning heart in all circumstances of time and space. It's for all peoples in all times. Now, we have to see how that's so. What about this statement here? Let's get controversial. It is put within the study of the great historical epic Mahabharata, which was especially prepared for the less intelligent class, namely the women, the laborers, and those who are worthless descendants of the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and higher sections of the Vaishyas. What do ladies think? We got quite a few former feminists there. The less intelligent class. And how do the men feel? Right? Wrong. Okay. What man here can tell me that he doesn't fit in any of these categories? In other words, as the Bhagavatam points out, in the age of Kali, everyone's born a Shudra. Kalo Shudra Sangha. So what man here can say that he's not a worthless descendant of Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and higher sections of the Vaishyas? The man can't even claim to be even worthless descendants of Brahma. You can ask, Rajadam, were your parents Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, or higher sections of the Vaishyas, and somehow you became a worthless descendant? So even this is complimentary. So in other words, we have to approach this text with some humility and not immediately stab with our preconceptions. Ooh, less intelligent class, namely the women. Why don't you read the rest of the sentence? No one's got any reason to be puffed up. But you have to understand the Bhagavatam's perspective. That in the age of Kali, everyone's worthless. So, okay, the women are less intelligent, and also, you read the rest of the sentence, you find that all the men are less intelligent too. Now, the ladies may just focus, they don't do this in New Zealand, but they may focus just on, it says, namely the women. And if the men are proud, which they aren't in New Zealand, they won't understand that they're being put down too by this text. The men are being put down too. So in that way, the Bhagavatam is even. But if you have all these preconceptions in your mind, if you're a woman who wants to feel offended, if you're a man who wants to feel proud, you'll miss the whole point. Chaitanya Prabhu and I were having a brief discussion yesterday about this, because it can be a hot issue, what to do about Prabhupada's books and in terms of saying controversial things. But if you look at many of the sections with a dispassionate, calm mind. You see, he's not giving the men any reason to be puffed up. The men are doing that to themselves. Also, I was discussing with Shesha Prabhu how you have to understand the Bhagavatam perspective and what it's presupposing. Even when the Bhagavatam is discussing women and their frailties, it's presupposing what? Real men. And where are they? So that's why the ladies get angry, because they know. We know. Unfortunately, they know. We know where these men are at. We know what they want. We know what motivates them. We know how they just grovel on the floor to gratify their senses. We know that. And they are more intelligent. The ladies are just not going to accept that. And so then they get angry at the Bhagavatam. And they try to, you know, wonder, why is Prabhupada saying these things, you know? Maybe he's just from Victorian culture or something like that. So if you just understand what the Bhagavatam is presupposing, and then see if it's there or not. I have gone through this explanation many times. Not so much in New Zealand, because we really don't have that problem. All the men can see who's really in charge. But other countries, in other countries, I had to explain that. Most recently in Los Angeles. And the ladies, some of them very educated, they said, no, this makes sense. This makes sense. They said, give us an Arjuna, give us a Yudhisthira, we'll surrender. Otherwise, forget it. Or give us 25% Arjuna, 25% Yudhisthira, and we 25% surrender. Fair enough. And there are other points to the discussion which I won't say now. But I just want to make this clear that you have to read Prabhupada's books with a calm mind and not just flip out every time you see something that, seems to trigger a knee-jerk reaction. This is what we tell when people buy Bhagavad Gitas. I always say, look, you're going to find things in this book that are familiar to you. You're going to find a lot that's not familiar to you. Just give it a fair go. Just get to the end. Read the whole book. And when you get to the last page, then you can make some judgments. And I always find that anyone who actually reads the whole Bhagavad Gita and gets to the end, their consciousness is transformed. So we're willing to do that service of helping people read Bhagavad Gita without disturbing their reading with preconceptions. That's why we have our outreach centers. We're willing to hold people's hands and help them turn the pages, rather than just say, how will they understand Prabhupada's books? Maybe those books are meant for another time. No, we see it as a service opportunity. All right, you say people don't read much these days? They're all absorbed in video games and mass weapons of distraction. Okay, well, that's an opportunity for more service from us. We've got to step up. We've got to bring our game to a higher level and deal with people who are much more distracted than they were in the 70s. Rather than just say, in the 70s they read more. It's true. In the 70s, as Shesha Prabhu can tell you, it was nothing unusual for someone to get a Bhagavad Gita from a book distributor, read the whole thing in 3 days and come running to a temple. Nothing. Now you ask someone to read Bhagavad Gita in 3 days? Even our devotees can't do that. Even our own devotees, come on, can't you make a Bhagavad Gita film DVD or something? I can watch the Bhagavad Gita film on DVD while I'm doing my email. And So yes, times have changed due to these weapons of mass distraction, but that just gives us more an opportunity to do service. Okay, people are distracted, no doubt. What can we do to aid them in their distracted, bewildered state? That's how a devotee thinks. In these present circumstances, how can I carry out the order of Lord Chaitanya? Bhagavad Gita is meant for all times and all places. So how can I help people to understand that? In other words, we don't have a defeatist attitude. I mean, look at this Bhagavatam. It's got funny language. It's got strange names. Even the title, Srimad Bhagavatam. How can you approach anyone with this? But you see, what people are getting from you when you approach them is your enthusiasm, your sincerity. When they buy a book, when they listen to you at an outreach center, they are buying into your enthusiasm and sincerity. They look at you and they think, well, that person's got something I don't have. Maybe if I get this book, maybe if I listen to them, listen to their talks or channel all of them, maybe I'll get what they have. That's what unconsciously they're thinking. Sometimes they even say it. Very few times you meet a person who, and I hear about it, it does happen. They just, I want the book. I just want the book. I tried to be like that the first devotee I talked to. I went looking for a devotee because I wanted Srimad Bhagavatam. As you know, I had ordered all my books from mail order in the USA, so I wouldn't have to talk to devotees. But then finally, I got a notice from the BBT that Srimad Bhagavatam is out. And so I said, oh, I can't wait. I've read all my books twice. So I walked up to a devotee and in a big bus terminal, 5,000 persons walking to home. I said, I thought I was asking just an ordinary question, routine. Just walked up to her and said, do you have Srimad Bhagavatam? So we all know this is very rare. It happens to our distributors sometimes. They tell me how, you know, they're distributing books somewhere and someone just walks by and immediately turns it. Is that Bhagavad Gita? I've been looking for that. I always remember one devotee told me how he was doing door-to-door here in New Zealand and he knocked on one door and the person looked at the book and said, I can't believe it. I'm seeing this book in houses everywhere in the whole country. I am a house mover. I know what's in people's houses. Everywhere I go, every house I move, it's got this book there. All right, he said, I give up. I'm going to get one too. So, sometimes you do meet persons who just want the book. But generally, people, as any in mundane sales, salespersons will tell you, they're buying the sales experience. They're not just exactly buying the product, they're buying hopes for a better life, hopes for happiness. And so if they approach Bhagavad Gita with that kind of mentality, that's fine, because it is correct. They will get a better life. Now just listen. Bhagavad Gita, as Prabhupada explains, can be consulted in all critical times. I know you're all too young to have critical times, right? Everything just goes your way, right? Especially when you're a teenager, right? Right, Prim? And in your 20s, it's no worries, mate, right? No critical times. Of course. Material existence in of itself is a critical time. It's a crisis. We're so foolish we don't see it that way. Give us a few happy-go-lucky days and we think, wow, this is, life is great. Life is good. But it can't last, and you know that. And when you look at your situation, in terms of it's your material situation, what you were like before fully taking up the practice of bhakti, it's horrifying. The stresses and strains that you willingly took on, the embarrassing situations you put yourself in, the crises that happened to you. Okay, if it's not family breakup, it's death in the family. This is a big thing in India because as of yet, the family breakup syndrome hasn't hit fully. But ask anyone from India, when there's a death in the family, it's very devastating because the family bond is so tight. So that tight family bond doesn't make one immune to crises. No, when there's a death in the family, everyone just suffers so much. I've seen it. Of course, now the younger generation of Indians, they're rapidly learning the art of how to have crises, how to go through critical situations, like, you know, how to get yourself in Western-type situations. In any case, material life, as we said, in and of itself is a crisis. It's a critical situation. We want the vision to be able to see that. So Bhagavad Gita will give you consultation in all critical times. Think about that. You can actually consult Bhagavad Gita. It's not just a book, you know, that you read for metaphysical knowledge, or a book you read because, well, you have to read. It's a book that can be consulted. Everyone would like to have their own personal consultant. Bhagavad Gita is doing that. And of course, we've spoken before about how we've tried to establish a guidance system to provide the wealth of consultation. Some take advantage of it, some don't. What can you do? But we want to make that opulence of guidance available. There are always going to be some who want to reinvent the wheel. There's nothing that can be done about it. My own motivation in trying to create a guidance system is that I want to be able to give the best to everyone. And I'd be a fool to think that I can personally advise every devotee on every aspect of their life at all times. No, we need hands-on consultants. Consultants who are close to the ground. In terms of the details of people's life. Because that's where the action is, in the details. In management circles, they have that expression, the devil is in the details. So we have a mentor system to work out those lifestyle details. And this is an opulence. It's not that the mentors are there, you know, to control you, make your life miserable. No, they're actually trying to give you the benefit of years of experience. You're going to get that from Shesha Prabhu's seminars. You're going to get the fruits of 40 years' experience in two ashrams. So, in a sane human culture, which is not what exists today, you value the wisdom of the elders. That's what makes even the present day version of Indian culture so successful. Because the elders in the past were wise, and the children would accept the wisdom of the elders. That's becoming, of course, not the case anymore. The elders aren't so wise, and the children aren't listening. But everyone needs an elder. So the mentor system is meant to provide that opulence so that you don't have to say, like the devotee was telling me last night, now that she's 30, oh, and I look back on
what I was like as a devotee when I was 20 or 21. Oh, stupid. Of course, I would be foolish to think that everyone's going to take advice. I was having this discussion with His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj, and he was describing how he said, you know, when I first started initiating disciples and running a project in Hungary, I thought, we're going to just help them avoid all the mistakes we made. And we're going to lay out a perfect system so that they don't repeat the mistakes that were done in the youthful days of back in the 70s of the Hare Krishnas. We're going to avoid all the lifestyle mistakes, all the marriage havoc, all the ashram confusion. We're just going to avoid all that. They're all going to listen. And after a while you realize, no, they're all not going to listen. There's always going to be a percentage who try to reinvent the wheel. Because we were discussing, to actually listen requires some degree of mode of goodness, sattva-guna. As long as rajaguna and tamaguna predominate, then I gotta be me. I gotta do it my way. It'll work out, don't worry. I feel good now. I feel all right. That's the Western mantra. Hey, I feel all right. That's all that counts. We'll make it work in the future somehow. Remember that famous statement? It's in Bhakti Bhava, a little book. Someone saying, all right, I know what I'm doing is not the Krishna conscious thing now, but it could be in the future. So this is Kali Yuga, and we'd be fools to think that everyone is going to be lining up to get guidance. All our devotees just, please, where's my mentor? It's not right. So we have to take into account that it is Kali Yuga, and we have to also deal with those who, they just can't see their way right now to accepting guidance. They're overwhelmed. And the mind and senses, and so we have to also realize that there needs to be flexibility for those who, you know, they just can't deal with their conditioning in the best way. So we don't want to reject them. We don't want them to feel persecuted. It's like parenting. Those of you who have teenage kids, you know, you just gotta, you know, you'd like that they did everything you said and they always consulted you, but you just know it. Some degrees, for every child, it's not going to happen like that. So you can't reject them out of love. You can't reject them. So you just have to work something out, like, and hope that in the future they realize that father knows best, mother knows best. It used to be a very popular TV show in the 50s. Do you remember that, Chase? Father knows best. They never had any TV show on that. The whole point of the TV show was to always show that father could solve all crises and could always approach father, he knows. My mother always made sure that I watched that TV show. Father knows best. It's not going to be like that for everyone. You know, there are different types of disciples at different levels. There are different types of devotees coming to Krishna consciousness. So we have to hope for the best while at the same time being flexible, you know, for the rest. Okay. Try to do something for Krishna. Try to keep yourself in the game somehow or other. Don't walk off the playing field. Maybe in the future you'll listen. I often tell the mentors when they're presented with a situation in which someone is determined to do something about which we've seen the movie so many times. It's a rerun. We know what the outcome's going to be. So I just tell the mentors, play for the rebound. Tell them what the best thing is. And then back off, let them do it their way, and then when the inevitable havoc comes, then you can say, play for the rebound. rebound, in case you don't know, in sports, I mean, someone takes a shot at the goal or something, and they miss. But, you know, you're right there to kick the ball in the net to get the rebound. Or in basketball, the shot misses, but the player on the same team is right there to push the ball in the basket. So, play for the rebound. Often that's what gurus, mentors, anyone giving spiritual advice has to do. You let them take their shot. Okay, this is not a good shot to take, you know, low percentage shot. You know, percentages are low, but you're going to make it, you know, but you're so determined, okay. And then you just position yourself for the rebound. Oh, so you missed the shot, huh? Maybe we should talk about that. And almost always the person is kind of, you know, is humble. Yeah, I should have listened. I guess I just had to learn the hard way. And this is all part of spiritual parenting as well as ordinary family parenting. So I'm explaining this to show that devotees are flexible. They're not fools. They learn how to cope with unwieldy situations. And devotees aren't utopians. As Srila Prabhupada once said that. We're not utopians. This is Kali Yuga. We don't expect everyone to just line up, you know, at the, you know, for consultations. Some are going to be elusive. Some you're not going to see at all. But still, we're trying to give the best thing. We go on giving the best thing, and in that way, the devotee becomes dear to Krishna. Otherwise, Krishna could just withdraw Bhagavad Gita. It's Kali Yuga, why bother? But what does Krishna tell Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita? He says, I speak it again and again. Even when the meaning becomes lost, I come, I speak it to make everything clear. So Krishna hasn't given up on us. So why should our spiritual superiors give up? Just because it's inevitable that some are not going to listen. Parents have great expectations for their children. Householders, they all long that my child will be a Prahlad. My child will be a Kunti Devi. It doesn't always happen. Or it may not happen immediately. Or Krishna, as what happened, as in the case of Maharaj Anga, Krishna may decide to give you a child that causes detachment, or a wife that causes you detachment. Naturally, all the ladies dream of marrying the ideal husband, however that's perceived in New Zealand. And most of the men dream of marrying the ideal wife who, you know, just waits on them hand and foot. And there's the dream that the child will be have a successful material career at the same time be a pure devotee. He'll be Shukadeva Goswami internally and a millionaire externally. But it doesn't work out like that immediately. All the time. Or it may not work out like that at all. Just look at Maharaj Anga. He was a pure devotee, but Krishna sent him a child of detachment, Vena. It was so horrible that finally Anga just left home in the middle of the night. So what do you think? Is this how Krishna treats his devotees? But Krishna knows what's best for each of us. I always quote His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj in his final days with us. His body just filled with cancer tumors. And what is he saying? He said, I wouldn't want it any other way. Is this for real? I wouldn't want it any other way. If I had to go through it again, I'd go through it again. Now how can someone, with their body full of tumors, say something like that? The only way they could be saying something like that is because they are tasting a higher reality that makes the body and its miseries inconsequential.
Basically, what he's saying is, what I've got is so unlimitedly superior, I don't care about the material situation. This is bhakti. The reality I'm tasting makes any so-called suffering I've gone through look like just insignificant. So let us understand that Bhagavad Gita is for consultation. It's got everything there about how to deal with your senses, how to deal with your mind, how to understand material nature. We'll go on to the next paragraph. Is it possible?
You should turn the projector on again.
I'll just read it. The merciful Lord left behind him the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita so that one can take the instructions of the Lord even when he's not visible to material eyesight. Material senses cannot have any estimation of the Supreme Lord, but by his inconceivable power, the Lord can incarnate himself to the sense perception of the conditioned souls in a suitable manner through the agency of matter, which is also another form of the Lord's manifested energy. Thus, the Bhagavad Gita, or any authentic scriptural sound representation of the Lord, is also the incarnation of the Lord. There's no difference between the sound representation of the Lord and the Lord himself. One can derive the same benefit from the Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna did in the personal presence of the Lord. Naturally, you think, well, if I was in Arjuna's position on that chariot with Krishna, I'd have no problems, right? If we turn on these fans, will it make a noise?
Yes.
Yeah, it'd be too much noise. No one knows. What do you think? You can derive the same benefit from the Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna did in the personal presence of the Lord. Can you accept that? No, it can't be so. A book is a book, and Krishna is Krishna. Right? This is what our material sense perception tells us. Bhagavad Gita is practical. Now let's talk about practicality, since this is the land of Kiwi ingenuity and practicality. There are persons who say that hardcore atheists are ruining the world, not because they're saying there is no supreme controller, supreme Ishvar. No, they're ruining the world because even though there is no supreme controller, religion, spirituality has very comforting benefits for human beings, even though it's not true. This is an important argument, especially here in this secular country, which has no religious pretensions. Why obliterate spirituality completely? All you have to do is just get rid of the fairy tales that, you know, these sacred books come from on high and that there's a supreme being. Just get rid of that and then look at the positive material benefits that religion and spirituality provides for human society. Great art, great music, nice festival events. So, the argument is that a benign atheist can participate in all these religious events, spiritual events, appreciating the human expression, but of course understanding that, you know, all religious scriptures are just fairy tales. That knowing that should not blind you to the benefit you can get from the spiritual experience. It's nice. Just like people come together for sports events, you know? Similarly, they come together for spiritual events. And it's nice, communal gathering, you know? So atheists should appreciate that positive value that religious fantasies, spiritual fantasies have for people. And not just
want to exterminate any trace of spirituality in human society, especially when human society has not come up with anything more comforting than spirituality. So atheists should be humble. They should admit that in telling the truth that spirituality is a fantasy, the Supreme Personality of God is a fantasy, in telling that truth, they should also, though, be humble and understand that believing in the fantasy has enormous benefits for human beings. What do you think? What are those benefits? Well, first of all, human beings need solace in crisis. They're always, just like in the USA, they had, you know, that case of someone bursting into a schoolhouse, school, and killing 20 children and 8 adults. And so everyone is just, it's agony. They were little kids, you know? What is it, 5 and 6 years old, something?
6 and 7.
6 and 7 years old? It was a 20-year-old killer. He killed his own mother. He did that before he went to the school. He shot his mother dead in her house and then went to a school and killed 26 and 7-year-old kids and 7 other teachers, including the principal. The lady principal heard the shots and saw him and just lunged at him. You know, an emotional reaction. She just lunged at him and he just shot at her. So, you know, these kind of events just tear at the human heart. Why? These little children, so innocent. You can imagine. It happened in New Zealand. This wasn't South Auckland. This was, you know, prosperous Remuera or something like that. Kapiti Coast. You send your kid to school, 6 or 7 years old, the kid's shot dead in a school with little kids. So the atheists, the benign atheists, the mellow atheists, they point out that religion is needed, spirituality is needed for situations like that, because the human spirit can't shoulder such events, can't bear the burden. And they say the atheists should be humble to understand that they haven't come up with anything better, any medicine better than spirituality. So let the people have the fantasies, recognize the positive value the fantasies give for such crises, and number two, for human bonding. The mellow atheists admit that nothing brings people in such communal harmony with each other than a spiritual event. And human beings need that. So rather than, they say, focusing on religious wars, focus on the community unifying spirit that religion and spirituality bring. And so therefore, their message to the hardcore atheists is just mellow out, calm down. Don't overlook the enormous benefit that spiritual fantasy has for human beings. Yes, you're advanced. As an atheist, you're most advanced. You're an Aryan. You realize the progressive values of life. But you should go a step further. You shouldn't be satisfied just with your superior knowledge that spiritual knowledge is a fantasy. You're one of the rare ones who reached that pinnacle, the topmost rung. Okay, but you have to go further and realize that even though spirituality is a fantasy, the fantasies have positive benefits for human society, and we haven't come up with any better way yet. So enjoy the spiritual music, the spiritual art, the spiritual festivals with your superior knowledge that you know it's all fantasy. And then you can be of real value for the world. What do you think? I can sympathize with that conclusion, because unless you have knowledge of this Bhagavad Dharma, the science of the Supreme, you would think like that. You have no knowledge. That's why Srila Prabhupada writes in the introduction to Krishna book, Anyone who actually knows what is God will accept Krishna. If you actually know what is the Supreme. If you don't know, then you have no way of evaluating or considering. Krishna? Little blue boy plays a flute? Even the demigods have problems sometimes understanding Indra, Brahma. Is this really the Supreme Personality of God? Not that they're atheists, but they have difficulty accepting that Krishna and Vrindavan is the ultimate. So they had to make some tests, so they had to cause some commotion like Indra did. Krishna himself explains this in Bhagavad Gita. Name vidu suragana prabhavam namaharshaya. Even the demigods, they don't know me. The greatest rishis, they don't know me. Adir hidevana. In every case, I'm the origin of the demigods. I was here before them. I had no cause. So Krishna explains himself so clearly in Bhagavad Gita, which is for all people in all times, in all places. It's meant to be our go-to book when we're going through a crisis, when you feel like Maya is overwhelming you, when you feel something's happened in your life that's left you speechless, like this schoolhouse killing, school killing in the USA. You can consult Bhagavad Gita. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.